This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm Tony Cox. Farai, you know, wedding season is just around the corner, and while planning the ceremony is hard enough, the real work comes after the I do's. One challenge many couples face is keeping the passion burning years after the honeymoon is over.
Well, Tony, I'm so glad you're married because you're going to help out with this Sex and Sexuality series on roundtable discussion on long-term relationships and intimacy. For more, we're joined by family and marriage therapist Dr. Ron Elmore. Dr. Ron is author of An Outrageous Commitment, The 48 Vows of an Indestructible Marriage.
And we are also joined by Linda Young, a counseling psychologist at Seattle University. Let me say welcome to the both of you.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
One quick word, though, before we get started. We are talking about sex, S-E-X. Now, sex isn't, nor should it be, a dirty word, but we do want to give parents of young children who are listening out there a heads up, okay? Everybody knows we're talking about sex. All right. So here we go. Here's my first question I'm going to put to you. As Farai said, I think I'm here because I'm the senior married person on the staff, and also because my wife has given me permission to talk about this on the radio. First question, what is the biggest difference between married sex and dating sex, or married sex and non-married sex, Dr. Ron?
I don't know that there's much difference at all in the first 90 days. It happens after you're married, though. The major difference is not the attraction, not the importance of the relationship, not even the technicals that have to do with lovemaking. It is the whole drama, that intangible kind of psychology that happens in our minds that says this is the same sex partner that I am going to be having next week and tomorrow and next year and year after year. And I think then some of the excitement level can be a challenge to achieve.
Well, Dr. Young, do you think that men, husbands, boyfriends see that differently than women, wives, girlfriends do?
I think they might, and I also think that there are some differences potentially in dating sex and married sex, in that when we're still dating and having sex, it might be around different agendas, and we might not know for sure what our partner is wanting in that relationship. And so we're on our best behavior, including our best sexual behavior, when it comes to dating sex. So if we're using sex as the lure, for example, if women are typically the gatekeepers of sex and men are typically the ones who make the overtures, we might be using sex in order to get something. And that sets up a power struggle or a power difference before we're married. After we're married, if the goal was to have the intimate relationship and keep it for a lifetime, then the truth comes out about what our sexuality is really all about. So it might not necessarily be different if we're dating honestly and with integrity and with genuine intimacy. But I find that a lot of people are dating with agendas and they might not be the same, and sex is a big part of how it gets played out.
So Dr. Young, what you're talking about is honesty.
Absolutely.
And, you know, honesty is something that has many different ramifications. It's how you talk to each other. It's also how you act. I mean, do you think that most people, in your experience, enter into a dating relationship or then later a marriage relationship with what you consider integrity?
I think they hope to, they want to, and may come close to it, but I do believe that we kind of present our idealized versions of ourselves when we're first meeting someone and entering a dating relationship. And over time, with the marriage, once we feel secure in the relationship, and I guess the key is when we can feel secure and have trust and allow ourselves to be more vulnerable, then we can feel our integrity come out in full force. When we feel like we have to protect ourselves and there's something that we might lose, it's harder to maintain our integrity because we're hoping to put our best self forward, or the self that we believe can't be hurt.
So one thing that I think is often a question for women is, do you offer yourself to a man? Will he respect you less if you do? Because there's that whole saying, you know, why buy the cow when you can get the milk for free? At some point, most men seem to want to taste the milk. And so should we take them at face value that that's actually what they want? Or is there something to be said for, you know, the leave the mysteries for later, you know, don't compromise yourself, all those. And of course, women are sexual actors, too. I'm not trying to make it as if women don't ever want to have sex. But there does seem to be this dichotomy. Maybe you can speak from the women's perspective. You know, if a woman feels like she's getting a message, you know, pressured to enter from, you know, other forms of intimacy, cuddling or whatever, into sex with someone who she's not married to. Could there be some problems with figuring things out once they reach that stage of marriage?
I think this is such a key question. One of the things that continues to amaze me is the endurance of the sexual double standard over time. It is still here. We might want to believe it's not here, but it's absolutely here. And women are viewed differently, especially by each other, if they are engaging in sexual behavior that people might think of as promiscuous or especially free. And there's an interesting paradox here, because if we hold on to our sexuality as if it's some sort of precious gift, and a lot of us feel that way about our sexuality, yes, it's precious, but if we think of it as the thing that we give away or give up or offer to someone, and not as an exchange or a sharing that's special and spiritual and even and equal, then we run the risk of treating our own sexuality like it's an object. And that makes us treat ourselves as an object, a precious object, nevertheless, but still an object. And so for the people who are holding their sexuality tightly and using it as a lure to get someone to wait for them, come forward, we run the risk of having them treat the whole thing like a game and think of us as an object to be won, as opposed to an equal to be shared with. Now, I totally agree that waiting for a while, waiting long enough to really know who you're dealing with, to know what each person's integrity is all about, to having some sense of trust, to having a sense of how responsible this person is, what their personality characteristics are, what their values are, and whether this is really a love interest or not, and what your values are. All of those are really good reasons to wait. But if you're just waiting so that you can have someone stick around until they've won you, then you run the risk of being an object.
All right, Dr. Linda Young, she's a counseling psychologist at Seattle University. She's here with Dr. Ron Elmore, a family and marriage therapist. He is author of An Outrageous Commitment, The 48 Vows of an Indestructible Marriage, and you are in the middle of our News and Notes roundtable. I am joined by NPR's Tony Cox. Tony.
As a matter of fact, Dr. Ron, I want to put this question to you from a male perspective. One of the things that you hear men talk about all the time as they are about to get married is, well, this is the last woman I am ever going to sleep with. And it's a fear that many men have. Talk about that fear, because you made reference to it in the beginning of our conversation. Talk about it, how long it lasts and how men get over it. Or do we ever get over that?
Yeah, I think it is certainly possible to get over it. I want to start back at the beginning of what you said. I believe it's very true for men. And as Dr. Young has pointed out, it's very much our responsibility to make sure that we don't let sexuality become an object. But I believe it is another thing, and that is symbol, particularly to men. Sex is full of all kinds of symbolic meaning for men, like how admired I am, how respected I am, how good I am. In a lot of ways, the things that men value most, we treat them as if it's a job to do. And sex is the part of love that is technical and mechanical and performance-oriented. And I think it's hugely appealing to men that way. And so when they think about the fact that in marriage relationship, here's this thing that I get to demonstrate my love with, and that is the symbol of sexuality and my performance in it, and my audience is going to be the same audience forever. I think at a certain point, men who, quote-unquote, get over it, it's because we choose another reward, and that is the reward of, here is another person who knows me and loves me in light of what I am and in spite of what I am, and that I have the familiarity and the richness of another kind of intimacy, even if I take a loss on having a huge and growing audience of fans for my sexual performance.
As black men, are we worse at that than other men? Better, the same, in terms of having that as a part of our psyche, this fear?
That is an area I'm not aware of being different between men. I believe that is uniquely male and not necessarily uniquely black, white, or other. It is that in the same way that often for women, generally speaking, the exchange of ideas and the exchange of emotions, the exchange of words is an intimacy symbol, I believe sexuality is a huge, potent intimacy symbol for men. And so it's not necessarily that more so for black men, but hugely for men.
Dr. Young, I remember something that a friend said to me once who'd been married. She has been, continues to be married, long-term, wonderful relationship. She said, well, what you give up in having more variety of partner, you gain in having trust. And trust means that you can engage in different behaviors over time. That, you know, maybe you were someone who just tried a very routine sexual practice, and then you vary that practice over time by adding more and more things that you try because you trust the person that you're with. Do you find that's true in good marriages?
I absolutely agree with that. When there's trust for a woman, she can really embrace her full sexual self and allow herself to experiment and know that she's going to be taken care of with her experimentation and it won't be used or abused. So some women absolutely flower over time with married sex. And in fact, some of the best sex of women's lives might come after 55, even after 60 years old. The toughest times for sexuality in marriage are after the birth of children, mid-career, where there's time management problems and raising children, a focus on the children. But the idea of trusting the person you're with and feeling free to explore a range of sexual interest is absolutely correct. I agree with that.
Dr. Young, let's talk about this children thing for a moment, because before my son was born, I was number one, at least I thought I was, in our relationship, okay?
Right.
And then he came along, and I didn't go from one to two. I went from one to four because he was first, she was second. The revitalizing of her career was third, and then I slipped all the way down to fourth, and it was a hard position to be in. Talk about that phenomenon.
You are not alone, not alone, not alone. That's one of the most common things I see when I work with couples. And I think it's one of the most common male fears around having children, is that there will be such a bond between mother and child that the mother is done getting touched after she's been, breastfeeding and holding the child and being pulled on for 4, 5, 6 years. And it's valid because a lot of attention does go into child rearing, and even more so for the mother typically than the father, although it's getting more even over time. And so one of the things that parents have to be aware of even before the child is born is to maintain their own couple relationship, set aside special time for the couple relationship as early as possible, weekly if possible, so that you can maintain those bonds that are so strong for you, which are also going to be good for the children. The best thing a child can have is two parents who show their love and affection for each other, and the child gets to witness that and know that that's a very strong bond.
So let me ask you, Dr. Ron, you just heard that explanation, plus you're an expert, plus you're a man. I don't know if you're married or not.
25 years worth.
So how did you have kids too?
Three.
All right, so you know what it's like. How did you deal with it, and how should we deal with it? We've heard what Dr. Young has said should happen, but I don't know how much of that actually does happen.
Well, I think I stand now and speak now with the wisdom that comes from looking back on it. We actually handled it pretty poorly, as do most couples, I think, the couples that I work with, pretty poorly. We learn a lot, and if we had another shot, we'd do it differently the next time. But I think the decision to have children shouldn't just be a decision about, do I have enough time to raise a wonderful child? It is, do I have enough time to raise a wonderful child and to maintain a marriage? So that it means now, lovemaking that used to be an event before children that would include ballads playing on the CD player and wind blowing in through the window, now sometimes becomes not this huge event, but these momentary and spontaneous quickies that have to be scheduled in, just like diaper changing and bottle feeding.
Amen.
It is, do I have the time to demonstrate, not just talk about, but to demonstrate the love that I say that I have? And it will come in new flavors and varieties now. Really quick ones, really long, extended, get a hotel room ones, and mostly ones that don't include long and extended.
Dr. Young, what about, I think that one of the things that has come up as I have gotten older, I'm not married, is that some people I know who are in married relationships or in committed relationships, they go through other life-changing events besides pregnancy. One person might become ill or disabled. Mm. All sorts of things happen. How do you keep intimacy alive when your partner is different from the person that you married in some profound way?
I'm glad you used the word intimacy instead of sex there as well, because that's really the key. And things like illness can wreak havoc on your sex drive, on your desire, on time, on whether you feel exhausted or not. And so can mental illness, for example. If someone is depressed, if someone is anxious, it's going to affect your sexual behavior. But if you're maintaining a truly intimate bond, even if you go for droughts and periods where no sex is happening, you have the generosity of spirit and the loving and the desire to take care of the relationship and empathize with what your partner is going with. And that's at the core of intimacy. So being able to be patient with the ebb and flow of passion in a relationship is what comes with intimacy.
You know, I would ask you also, Dr. Ron, to talk about, I think that you made an interesting point. Sex becomes work at some point in a marriage relationship. Now, that's not a negative thing. It just means if it's important enough to you, you have to carve out some time and make it work. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. And I think when we get away from the idea that there's something lesser about that, we expect that all the other areas of our lives require some technical work we do. We enjoy having careers that fulfill our bliss and our passion, but we expect that that will include some mechanics and some discipline. And in some way, we may get a bit offended that romance and intimacy and love require some mechanics. But the truth of the matter is, what's so rich about our sexual relationship, particularly in marriage, is that this is the place that I am willing to do the boring discipline work for us to have a relationship sexually that matches where we are now. It can't just match where we started out.
That's where we're going to have to leave it, Dr. Ron. Good point. Dr. Ron Elmore is a family and marriage counselor in Sacramento, California, and the author of An Outrageous Commitment, The 48 Vows of an Indestructible Marriage. And Linda Young is a psychologist at Seattle University. She joined us from member station KUOW in Seattle, Washington.
Thanks, guys. And one last thing. This Wednesday, we're going to host another special roundtable, this time on fidelity. We want to hear how you've kept the love alive. Just visit our blog, News and Views. There's the link at the top of our webpage, npr.org/news and notes.